I feel a little bit like I'm past my sell-by date.
The whole body gets affected by these changing levels of estrogen.
He's just trying to eat and he's just trying to breathe.
Yeah, like... To be fair, I get those thoughts and I've got none of this going on. Well,
low libido is a really common symptom in menopausal women.
For me, my main symptom, I think, was just not coping as well.
Perimenopausal or menopausal women tend to put on weight around their tummies.
And I guess it's so difficult because also all women experience it differently.
That's actually really damaging for the UK economy, as well as the lady herself. That when you are perimenopausal, you still need contraception.
Yeah.
Your period stopped. Because every now and then there'll be a surprise.
And what about us husbands that maybe notice the signs, like what sort of support?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Hi everyone, I'm Emily.
And I'm Matt.
And welcome back to our podcast, What They Don't Tell You.
But we will.
Yes, and today I am so excited. We are joined by Dr. Alice Scott. She is a GP and a British menopause specialist, and she's actually my doctor, and she's here to talk about all things perimenopause, menopause and women's health. So welcome, Alice.
Thank you. Thank you so much for asking me to come on.
No, I'm so glad that you said yes, because I was in your office. I was like, I don't suppose you fancy coming on my podcast, but I'm so thrilled because whenever I've talked about perimenopause or menopause on my YouTube channel, I'm just blown away by the messages that I get. I think people are so interested. Maybe it's my target market, but
yeah.
You know, there's so much misinformation and there's so much around it that people maybe just need to know more.
Yeah.
But before, we've got so many questions for you, but before we do get into it, I would love to know just like a little bit of background and why you actually got into women's health specifically. Yeah.
So I'm a GP and menopause specialist at Essex Private Doctors. And I suppose the reason I got into women's health and menopause was mainly due to my mum's experience with menopause. So my mum was on HRT for quite severe menopausal symptoms. And then in the sort of early 2000s, there was a big trial called the Women's Health Initiative trial, which came out. And this appeared to show that there was a big increased risk of breast cancer and strokes on HRT. And at that time, it was really in the media, loads of really sensationalist headlines saying that it was very dangerous to be on HRT and that women should come off. And at that point, she came off HRT. And I can remember coming back from university and basically she was really struggling. She wasn't sleeping. She was having terrible hot flushes. She was finding it difficult to regulate her emotions and her mood. And it was a really difficult time. And then there was a reanalysis of all of the data. And it appeared that initial big study was actually quite flawed. Mm. So the data was re-looked at and it seemed that that risk of breast cancer had been exaggerated. So at that point, she went back to a doctor. She found it quite difficult to get a doctor's appointment. But when she got one, she then went back on to HRT. And the relief that she experienced within 3 weeks of being on HRT was really significant. And I can remember during that time when she was off it, you know, we tried everything. She was trying herbal options, you know, lots of non-hormonal options, and it just didn't work. Mm-hmm. So after that, there was this new NICE guideline that came out shortly after that. And I suppose all of that together kind of got me really interested in the field, and I was felt really passionate about helping other ladies who were going through a similar experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because the rates of HRT prescribing had halved after all of these sort of headlines. So there were a lot of women struggling, and it takes a long time for medical prescribing habits to change. So there were a lot of women who did need help. So that's why I got into it.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, that's so interesting, because I guess you saw firsthand then the impact of someone who actually needs it that's not taking it. And that report did so much damage, didn't it? I mean, I've been trying to educate myself about perimenopause, and I think that report, the people that were in it were actually in their 60s.
That's
so
right.
It wasn't very representative. Mm-hmm. Because they would have a higher case of cancer anyway.
Yeah, so that's right? Exactly right. So the women in that study were a lot of them were over the age of 60, which is not really the main group of women who would come to see me. Of course, some women do, but often it's younger women. And those older ladies are at already an increased risk of heart disease and stroke because they're a bit older. And also the types of HRT that were prescribed in that study were quite old-fashioned. They're very rarely prescribed now. So conjugated equine estrogen, which is the old-fashioned estrogen made from horse's urine, it's unusual to ever prescribe that now. Mm-hmm. And the type of progestogen that was prescribed is also a very synthetic, old-fashioned progestogen. So the newer HRTs come with less of a risk of breast cancer than those hormones did. Mm-hmm. So the data was kind of interpreted in the context of the wrong group of women.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously something I've come to learn of late, but perimenopause was something I didn't know anything about. And now I know a few of the symptoms. What is perimenopause and what are the symptoms? Should we clarify?
Yeah. So perimenopause is a spectrum. You don't just become perimenopausal. There's a very slow progression from being premenopausal, which is where you're having regular periods, to a slight, usually one of the first symptoms is a change in period. So they might become lighter or heavier. Sometimes they're spreading out. Sometimes they're getting closer together. And coupled with that tend to come a group of symptoms due to fluctuating levels of estrogen. So before perimenopause, your estrogen levels are quite predictable during your menstrual cycle, so during your period cycle. And then during perimenopause, they become a lot more erratic. And eventually, your estrogen levels would fall once your ovaries have stopped producing estrogen, so low that your periods would stop. And once your periods have stopped for over a year, that's when we would say you are postmenopausal.
Right.
And there are lots, and we have estrogen receptors on every single cell of our body. So the whole body gets affected by these changing levels of estrogen. So for example, probably the most common symptom is hot flushes and night sweats, because the temperature sensor in the brain starts going faulty due to the changing levels in estrogen. Another really common one I see is mood change. So part of the brain that helps us with emotional regulation can change with fluctuating levels of estrogen. So some women might get more anxious, they might get low in mood, they may find that they respond in situations less predictably than they did before, so they might feel irritable, or sometimes women will just say, I feel like I'm not as resilient as I was, or I feel like I'm a bit more overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Lots of other ones too, so joint pain, joint stiffness, muscle pain, generalized kind of fatigue. Women just feel exhausted and out of sorts. Often if they're having night sweats, their sleep might be quite disturbed, so that will impact upon it. So there's a whole host of symptoms. And another really important one is vaginal dryness and urinary symptoms, which a lot of the time women don't tell me about unless I specifically ask them.
Yeah.
And so they might become more uncomfortable to have sex, for example, or they might be getting urine infections. So it really does affect the whole body.
Yeah. And I think that's something that's so difficult, is there are so many symptoms. It's not that it's one size fits all. You know, you don't just always experience hot flushes. Like for me, my main symptom, I think, was just not coping as well anymore. But then you must feel silly going to a doctor and saying, I'm just not really coping. And I don't know why, I just don't really feel myself. But it was perimenopause for me. Mm. So I know it's really difficult to put an age bracket on perimenopause, but can you give like a rough age when it can kind of start? Mm.
So the average age in the UK of period stopping altogether is 51, and perimenopausal symptoms usually happen between 4 to 6 years before your period stop.
Okay.
1 in 100 women will have their last period below the age of 40. So actually anywhere between 40 to 45 upwards is when perimenopausal symptoms can begin. And sometimes they're really quite subtle. Mm-hmm. It might be that you're having regular periods, but you start getting sweaty before a period, or you start having difficulty sleeping before your periods, because in the normal period cycle, you get a drop in estrogen before you bleed. And that can mimic some of the menopausal symptoms. Mm-hmm. And then another common kind of very early perimenopausal symptom is worsening of PMS. Mm-hmm. So women might notice that their moods get significantly worse just before a period. And this is really common in the transition to perimenopause. Mm-hmm. So I would say that all women in their 40s, it's kind of prime time for things to start developing.
Mm-hmm. So would you recommend people do sort of like track their cycles, or what's a good way to start, you know, understanding if you are in perimenopause?
Yeah, so I think it's useful to track your cycle. I mean, many women will be on contraception, which will mean that they are not having natural periods on their contraception. For example, if women are using a Mirena coil, often they won't bleed, or they might get unpredictable bleeding. If women are on the combined oral contraceptive pill and they're taking it 3 weeks on, 1 week off, they're getting that monthly bleed, but it's not necessarily representative of what their body is doing. I think it's about being in tune with how you're feeling, but also remembering that perimenopause isn't the answer for everything.
Yeah.
So we know that our modern day lifestyle has a really big part in how we feel. So a lot of women will be juggling a job, their family, maybe aging parents, maybe they've got young children, and there's a lot going on. And
a lot of factors, yeah.
So much stress.
And a lot of people find it difficult to make the lifestyle changes that are needed. And I think that's one thing to be a bit wary of, is not putting it all down to menopause, but also looking at your stress management too, because sometimes you can blame it all on the menopause, but it's actually a lot of other things going on.
Yeah, that's fair, I think. Yeah.
That's to be your suggestion, that there's other things going on. I couldn't say that it was anything else.
But can weight gain be a clue or a symptom of?
Yes, so often women, due to the fluctuating levels of estrogen in the body, it can increase inflammation in the body, and that can increase the likelihood of weight gain, particularly around the middle. Pre-menopausal women, not menopausal women, tend to put on weight around their bottom and their hips, whereas perimenopausal or menopausal women tend to put on weight around their tummies, which is a more dangerous place to put it on because it comes with an increased risk of diabetes and heart disease. Weight gain is also due to a number of other factors, though, particularly lifestyle. And we know that highly processed foods, which are often high in sugar and high in fats and unhealthy fats, and also increase the amount of inflammation in the body, therefore causing more weight gain. That has a really big part to play on weight as well, and stress, because stress increases cortisol, which is our stress hormone, and that also increases weight gain. So although it is more common in menopause, it's not always just the hormones that change that.
Could you explain then the dangers of doing nothing during menopause, perimenopause?
So I think one option is to do nothing, because there are some women who want to take a natural approach, who don't want any medical intervention. I think we need to be careful that we don't label menopause as a disease, because it is actually a natural process in a lady's life. And there will be some women who just want to go with the flow and not take action. But it depends how much that affects how they are and how they function in their everyday life. For example, there are some women who don't have any symptoms at all. And if they have a really healthy lifestyle, like they're doing lots of exercise, they're doing resistance training, therefore they're protecting their bones from osteoporosis. And they're also reducing their risk of heart disease, and they're making sure that they eat well, so their cholesterol's well managed, they're not diabetic, that will also reduce their risk of heart disease. So it is okay to do nothing. And I do think there is a group of women who, with the HRT being so much in the media, which is important because it helps a huge number of women, but it does sometimes mean women feel under pressure to go onto HRT, or they feel like if they can't have it, for example, usually women who've had breast cancer can't have HRT, they feel like they're missing out somehow. But I think it is important to look at the really powerful effect of lifestyle. That's one of the most important things that I tell all women, whether they go on HRT or not. We know that hormone replacement therapy is the most effective way of treating menopausal symptoms. There are some non-hormonal options too for women who can't have HRT. But the evidence is that HRT will be the most effective, and it also comes with the greatest health benefits too. So when you replace estrogen back to a premenopausal level, that will reduce the likelihood of the bone thinning, provided it started below the age of 60 or within 10 years of the last period. It also has been shown to reduce the risk of heart disease. There's some evidence that it can also help boost immunity. Some types of HRT have been shown to reduce the risk of bowel cancer, and it helps with cognition. So there are some women who really can't think clearly in their menopause, and it can help with that. It's really important for women. Often they struggle at work with their menopause. So for example, if you can't think straight, if you're exhausted, many women will tell me they feel it's impacting on the ability for them to do their job. So it's important to try and help these women, because we know that, you know, half the population is female. We live a third, women live a third of their life being postmenopausal. And when you look at the UK economy, women in that age group, over 40, one of the largest demographics. So if you have women who are leaving their job because they feel like they can't manage, that's actually really damaging for the UK economy, as well as the lady herself.
Yeah. And I guess it's so difficult because also all women experience it differently. Like, I've spoken to friends who are, you know, just not there yet, or I've spoken to older women who sailed through, as they said. So everyone also experiences it in a different way. So I guess it's dependent on you as well and your symptoms. Because when I came to see you, you know, I think you were like, you know, we go more on the symptoms that you're experiencing. Because for me, I really started feeling it at like 38, which maybe is quite young compared to other people. I actually started, sorry, this is really TMI, but I started my period very young. Has that got anything to do with the age that you then go into perimenopause, or not at all?
No, I don't think there's any significant evidence. There is sometimes a pattern with in the family. So for example, if your mum had gone through her menopause at an early stage, sometimes it will follow that daughters will also, or, you know, if you have a sister and she goes through it at an earlier age. But in terms of the timing of the periods, I don't think it makes much of a difference.
No. Okay. And obviously, you have a private practice locally, which is where I found you. I was obviously seeking out like help, but I did feel a little bit let down by, I guess, my normal GP. I felt a little bit fobbed off, and I felt that that can be like a theme, you know, from speaking to other women in a similar situation. Do you, like, in your opinion, do you think some women are let down by the medical system, like when they go to talk about these symptoms?
Yeah, I think so. And that's partly because it takes a long time for medical habits to change. So, you know, when these studies came out and were, you know, the medical professional was were scared to prescribe HRT because they were frightened that they would be increasing women's risk of breast cancer. And once that's been drilled into you, particularly doctors that were training at that time, it makes it a really difficult habit to move away from. And remember that general practitioners are experts in a whole range of conditions. So not everybody has had menopausal training. This is changing. There's a lot more now in the medical sphere about it, and a lot more has been done for medical education for GPs. But unfortunately, sometimes some GPs will reach for non-hormonal options like antidepressants in preference to HRT. Where probably the lady would have done better on HRT. There are, of course, some situations where if a lady is truly depressed and she's optimised lifestyle and she's had talking therapy, where an antidepressant may well be more suitable than HRT for that lady. But on the whole, for menopause, it will be HRT, which is a really good option.
I do feel really lucky that I'm sort of going through it now, because I think maybe 20, 30 years ago, if I'd gone to the doctor and said, you know, I'm just really not coping, I've got anxiety, which I've never had before, maybe I would have been prescribed antidepressants.
I mean, it is one of the most common things that ladies coming to see me have either been given and tried and they haven't really worked, or they've been offered them but thought to themselves, that's really not what I feel I need. Because there is a difference between hormone-driven mood change and true depression. And many women, they may feel a bit flat, they may feel a bit anxious, but they're not depressed. Mm. They still have times where they experience feelings of joy or excitement. And they know that they're not depressed, they're just not themselves. Mm. So, but I do think because of the scare, you know, the scare of the breast cancer risk, there is no increased risk of breast cancer with prescribing antidepressants. Mm. So that's what some GPs will still lean towards. Mm. But I do think it is changing.
If someone is watching or listening to this now and they're thinking, oh, maybe I'm experiencing some symptoms, what should they do? Like, what I almost want to give people like a bit of a plan, because yeah, when I started, I was a bit like, oh, I don't know what to do with this. Yeah. So I didn't really know.
So I think the first thing to do is it's useful to try and understand menopause. And there are some really good resources. So Women's Health Concern, which is the patient arm of the British Menopause Society, has got some really brilliant explanations on there and resources that women can read. There are also, I would always steer clear of forums. I find that there's a lot of misinformation on the internet. So I would recommend not joining menopause forums and reading things on there, because it's often inaccurate. If you feel that you are menopausal, and if it's awful, then you should see your GP straight away. But if things are mild, you might want to look at real optimization of lifestyle first. Mm-hmm. And then it would be about seeking medical review. Mm-hmm. And describing to the doctor how you are feeling. Helpful also to have tracked your periods a bit, but bear in mind that some women actually have normal regular periods when they develop menopausal symptoms. So just because your periods hasn't changed doesn't mean that you're not menopausal. Mm-hmm. Some people will come and say to me, but don't I need a blood test to diagnose it? And I would say that is unusual to need a blood test to diagnose menopause, because in the perimenopause, with the fluctuation in estrogen, all that happens is that that blood test result will tell me at the moment I put the needle in the vein, that's what your estrogen level is. But actually, your estrogen level can fluctuate even a couple of hours later. It might be quite totally different. So you can end up in a scenario where you get a blood result that says, oh, you're premenopausal. But actually, that's because that was just when that blood test was taken. Later on, it might have been different. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest that unless you're under the age of 40, it's not all, and sometimes under the age of 45, it's not always needed to do a blood test, because that sort of a combination of symptoms is so much more important. Mm-hmm. Rather than looking at blood test results.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what about us husbands that maybe notice the signs, like what sort of support?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. had I known.
But I felt like even I didn't know.
No,
I just knew the week before my period, if you ate near me.
Yeah, but now that there's so much more awareness, I feel like husbands may be looking for those signs. But it's obviously a sensitive subject, especially perimenopause. Yeah. To suggest to your wife, do you think it could be this? How can guys support in a subtle way?
I think it's really difficult. And understanding what menopause is and recognizing that it is a thing, because traditionally I think there's quite a lot of stigma around talking about menopause. We know that people find it difficult to even talk about periods. Periods are all a secret. Nobody talks about the periods. Mm. And hopefully that is changing now. But it was one of those things that was private and silent and women didn't talk about. And now that it's quite rightly discussed much more freely, I think having an understanding of how hormones can affect that lady and how she feels is the most important thing. And then just offering a safe space to listen, to be sympathetic, and to encourage her to go to see her doctor if she feels that she needs to, and reassuring her that there's a lot that can be done. Mm-hmm. I think it's about the reassurance and support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard, because when I started experiencing them, I found you really irritating sometimes. But then I had to take a step back and think, like, it would be like him breathing or eating. And then I'd think, he's just trying to eat and he's just trying to breathe.
Yeah, like, to be fair, I get those thoughts and I've got none of this going on.
Well, yeah. But yeah, it is hard for guys. But I, again, I feel grateful that things have moved on a bit. Like even, you know, my son's learning about sex education. Yeah. Like when we were young, we'd be split.
Yeah, absolutely.
So like girls would learn about periods. Yeah. Boys wouldn't. And it was all a secret, whereas now, you know, they're taught.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember at school when we learned about periods, we were given this secret little bag of tampons and sanitary towels and everybody snuck them in their bags so that the boys didn't see. And it was totally different to how it is now.
There is that shame around it. It's funny. And even when I talk about perimenopause to friends or online, I feel a little bit like I'm past my sell-by date. Because it's like you get given this amount of eggs so you can reproduce and have these babies. And like, well, you've done it now, so.
I think that's really common. And it's a sense some women will feel this sort of sense of bereavement, really, that their fertile years are done with.
Yeah.
And also for many women, perimenopause comes at a cruel time because you're also juggling a lot. Your children might be older, they might be going to university, you're juggling a new role within their lives where they're maybe less dependent on you in the ways they used to. Some women feel that they have to adjust their sense of self. They're not sure what their purpose is. Mm. And it requires a mental shift. Mm-hmm. And if your children are moving away from home, it's like that empty nest syndrome. Mm-hmm. It is a lot going on for menopausal women.
Mm-hmm. That's it. It's like you might have teenagers, but aging parents. And like you said, like you've been a mum for so long and now that's, and then that's literally the cutoff as well, that like you could never again.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing to mention is that when you are perimenopausal, you still need contraception.
Yeah.
So your period stopped. Because every now and then there'll be a surprise.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah.
Going back to lifestyle changes, what actual lifestyle changes can women make?
So I think one of the most important things is movement. And I call it movement because when you say to somebody, you've got to exercise, sounds a bit like a chore. And the movement is so important for everybody, but particularly menopausal women, because there are three main types of exercise I'd suggest. So restorative exercise, which is things like yoga or Tai Chi, Pilates. If you don't want to go and do classes, there's lots of stuff on YouTube. You can make your own 5-minute routine at home. But that's really important for reducing stress and reducing cortisol stress hormone. And also it can help with flexibility as well and balance. Resistance training, which is weights, are really important for menopausal women to help with bone strength. So that might be with dumbbells or resistance bands or body weight exercises like squats or press ups. And then cardiovascular exercise, which is where you're getting your heart rate up. So that might be walking, running, swimming, cycling, even just dancing around your kitchen, something to get you a bit breathless.
Yeah.
And in an ideal world, you do 150 minutes a week of cardiovascular, which is 5 times a week for 30 minutes. Or you can split it into longer sessions if you wanted to and do it less frequently.
Yeah.
And the resistance training should be 2x a week. And I normally recommend the restorative exercise, just 5 minutes a day. And that often makes it, even that 5 minutes makes a real difference to women's stress levels. And as well as the exercise, there's so much that we can do with our diet too. So we know that our gut microbiome, which is the healthy bacteria in the gut, is influenced by what we eat. And that healthy bacteria can help increase the amount of serotonin, which is our happy hormone, and it can help with hormone regulation. So reducing the amount of processed foods that you have, cooking from scratch, making sure you get enough protein. Menopausal women need more protein than other groups of people, and also making sure that you eat regularly as well. Usually recommend a Mediterranean type diet. Makes a real difference. And looking at stress management from other aspects like breathing exercises, mindfulness, meditation, all of this is really important for reducing stress. The more medical evidence we keep coming across is how dangerous for our health that stress is. We need a little bit. We need a bit, you know, if you're in a dangerous situation or you've got something exciting that you're doing, you need a little bit of stress there so that you can perform and you can, you know, if you're in a dangerous situation, you go and run away. But when you're just chronically stressed the whole time, this has such negative health effects.
You actually said something to me about, I mentioned, or I felt like I had a loss in libido, and you explained something to me, which was like a good tester of like, if that was true.
About the holidays.
Yes. Yeah.
So low libido is a really common symptom in menopausal women. And it's off sometimes due to hormone change, but we also know that stress has a negative impact on libido. And what I'll normally say is, what happens when you go on holiday? If you went away on holiday and it's just the two of you, what would happen to your sex drive? Mm. And if that lady says, oh, it would be fine, that's a really good test that it's probably your lifestyle that's actually impacting on libido, because we know that when we're really busy, you get tired. Often children around is a pretty good mood killer. So there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of lifestyle things which impact upon it. Long-term relationships are also one of probably the number one mood killer, because anything over 18 months, off the relationship has changed. And I think couples that have been together a long time, there is a shift in the dynamic. Often, if you remember back to the beginning, you might have felt butterflies in your stomach. It felt exciting when you had sex. It maybe felt new. But once you've been together a long time, it's usually quite predictable. And sex might be the same every time. And if you are having normal mundane life where you're juggling children and a job, and then you're expecting to switch it all in, on in the bedroom, then that's probably unrealistic. And I think that sex is important for many people in their relationships. Not everybody. Some people's, I think we have to remember that some people, sex does not play a part in their relationship, or it's not so important. But for a lot of people, that intimacy is important for keeping relationships strong. And trying to find time. So date night sounds very corny, but actually finding time to be alone and to do nice things together is important for keeping that sexual currency going. So sexual currency means that you are having sexual thoughts about each other at times when you're not just up in bed. So for example, you know, you've gone for a walk, just the two of you, and you're holding hands, or you have a passionate kiss that doesn't necessarily lead to sex. That's kind of sexual currency, or the appreciation of somebody that you look at them, you love them, you fancy them. That's sexual currency, and that gets lost in long-term relationships quite frequently. And you have to work towards getting it back. And that has a really big impact on libido. Of course, there are some women that will benefit from the addition of testosterone if they have low libido in menopause. But it's not a miracle worker, testosterone. It's not going to make your life less stressful. And so, and you know, and the other thing that's really important actually is whether the vagina's sore too, because if you've got dry vaginal dryness or soreness, you know, we want to avoid pain, so it will put you off. So that's really important as well to see. That's something that can be very easily treated, vaginal dryness, by seeing your doctor. So in answer to your question, libido is pretty complex.
No, but I think that's really good. Like, that's like the a good tester. Like, you know, can you go for a weekend away together, and like, how do you feel? If you still feel like uninterested, like maybe it's something you could talk to your doctor about.
I think you could actually definitely talk to your doctor about it.
Yeah,
but also remember that there is no normal for sex, and so it's not always helpful to compare to your friends about how many times you have sex per week or per month. It's very, very individual to the couple.
And so that's obviously testosterone.
Yeah,
but can we briefly talk about like all the hormones that we do need? Because I didn't even know that it's, is it the three of them?
Yeah, so there are three main hormones that we prescribe. Estrogen helps fix the majority of symptoms, because we bring, that's the hormone that's fluctuating in perimenopause. So we bring that back to a premenopausal level. If you have a womb, and in some occasional cases when you don't have a womb, you would go on to another hormone called progestogen. And the reason we go on that is because if you have a womb and you're only on estrogen, your womb lining will thicken, and that can increase the risk of womb cancer. So you have to go on progesterone in order to prevent that from happening. Testosterone is added on. Not all women require testosterone. You don't have to replace it. We know that it's dropping from your late 30s. That's Mother Nature's way of saying, what's the point in having sex because you're not fertile anymore?
I had a pressing.
But some women do benefit from testosterone for their libido, sometimes for energy too. There's a lot of, there's new evidence coming out all the time on testosterone about whether it has cognitive benefits. And some women do tell me that they feel perhaps mentally sharper on testosterone, or their concentration's better. But at the moment, the medical studies haven't proven that. But we only need to consider adding that on if a lady was symptomatic, there's less medical safety data around the prescribing of testosterone, which is unlicensed for women. So if a lady felt brilliant on her estrogen and progesterone alone, then you wouldn't think about adding in testosterone. It's just there as an extra option if it's needed.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone can have hormonal replacement, so it's probably important we talk about non-hormonal options.
Absolutely. So the main group of women who can't have HRT usually will be women who have a history of a hormone-dependent cancer. That's usually a breast cancer. There are some very rare gynecological cancers too. And options for those ladies, there are non-hormonal prescriptions that can be given, for example, antidepressants, which can not just have an effect on mood and improve mood, they can also reduce the frequency of hot flushes. Fezolinetant is a newer medication which works at the temperature sensor in the brain, which can help reduce hot flushes too. There are some herbal options like red clover or black cohosh. They're not generally considered suitable for women with breast cancer, but some women who want to take a more natural approach to their menopause could consider them. They help a little bit with hot flushes, but they're not as effective as HRT, for example.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. But there's options there.
Yeah, there are options there. And I think that the other thing to mention is the benefit of CBT, so cognitive behavioural therapy, which is has been added into the NICE guidance, so the national guidance on how to manage menopause, because we know that cognitive behavioural therapy, talking therapy, can make a real difference to women, women with mood disorders in particular, like anxiety or low mood. But also it has been shown to help the reduction of hot flushes for some women. So that's a really important thing to consider as well.
Oh, well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
As I said, I'm just so grateful that, like, you know, things have moved on, that there are practices like yours. Like, so you've got a menopause clinic in Brentwood.
So Essex Private Doctors is a private GP clinic, and we have 6 doctors working there, and I do my menopause clinic within it. Mm-hmm. I'm the medical director of the practice, and it's not just menopause there. So we offer full scope of general practice. So we see adults, children, the elderly. We do our blood tests on site. We do ECGs. We do minor surgery. We have an allergy clinic there. Do home visits. So it's we try and make it as comprehensive as possible. And there's another menopause specialist also working with me, Dr. Eleanor Beddow. And we've got lots of appointment availability. So if people want to book, you can either call the clinic, have a look at our website, which is essexprivatedoctors.com. Mm-hmm. And also I have my own menopause website, which is dralicescott.co.uk. And there's a lot of information on there, particularly about menopause blogs that I've written, and lots of information if people want to look at that too. And you can book appointments through the websites or just by calling us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We end every podcast with the same question. And I know you are actually a mum yourself. So I'd love to ask you, what's one thing you wish you'd known before becoming a parent?
So the one thing I wish I had known is that everyone is an amateur as a parent. So you do not know what you are doing. Mm-hmm. And I think you can read all the baby books you want to read, but once your children are born, you are winging it like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And I think that's sometimes quite reassuring for people to know, because particularly if you're somebody who likes to read lots of books or looks at lots of social media things about parenting, you might feel that you're inadequate, not knowing what to do straight away. And actually that's very normal. Mm. So that's the one thing I think I'd known beforehand.
Yeah, that's actually really nice coming from a doctor, because it's like even you felt like you didn't know what you were doing.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing from a medical perspective is that to reassure parents that they do usually know their children best. So if you felt that your child was unwell and you had that gut feeling that something is not right with my child, always I'd encourage you to act upon that, because usually you are right. Mm. And so I'd always recommend, if you ever got that feeling, that people did take their children to the doctor for review.
Yeah, that's such good advice, because you just know them so well, don't you? Oh, well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Yeah, no, well, I will put all of your details in the description of the podcast and of the YouTube video as well, so people can find you, that, you know, contact you, and also find out more information on your website. And of course, I would love you guys to comment any questions that you might have in the comments of this as well, and follow, rate, review, all the good things on this podcast as well. And yeah, thank you so much for watching and listening, and we will see you on our next episode. Bye guys.
See ya.
Bye.